Welcome to the Family Story Podcast, where we talk about family relationships, important family events, and most of all, family stories that can be passed on for generations to come. I'm your host, Rick Jensen, and I'm glad you've joined us today. So sit back, listen, learn, and love as we talk about your family in this episode of the Family Story Podcast. Thank you for joining us today on the Family Story Podcast. This interview is part two of Ernie Jensen's life story. He's my grandpa, and this interview was done posthumously, as we talked about in our first interview. This particular interview is going to be focused on Ernie's young life, the coming of age, if you will, and the excitement and adventures of young manhood. Last time we were together, Ernie, you mentioned that you were quite a runner. You were very fast. So I'm curious, being so fast, did you have an opponent who was just as fast, or did you have any confrontation in any of those races?
This one time, this guy from down the river, his name, he used to be Keel's boss, McGill was his name, and he was mean. He was really mean. He came up to this guy and pulled out this big, long six-shooter. It seemed to me like it was a foot long. And he says, "Don't let that Jensen kid run anymore." The guy says, "Why?" And he says, "Well, he's winning all the races, and none of the other kids got a chance." And he says, "If you don't," he says, "I'll drop you." Just then another guy, big burly guy, walked up and had his hand in his coat. I don't know if he had a pistol or what he had, but anyway, this guy says to him, he says, "If you drop me, he'll drop you, so you won't be ahead anyway." So I says to this guy, I said, "Maybe I hadn't better run any more races." And he says, "I'd already won four." And he says, "No, you run and you win if you can." So I says, "All right," and I won big. I 4 or 5 feet ahead of him when he quit. And I just run, grabbed my money, and took off through the crowd. And I never did see that guy anymore, and I never went near the races anymore. That day, I was scared to death. I never was so scared in my whole life.
Oh, wow. Did you have anybody who overheard what was going on or was a witness to what was going on?
I remember Howard Blackenberry, when I was getting trees out, I says, "Howard, can you remember that instant?" "Can I?" He says, "Man, I was as white as a sheet." He says, "I thought sure he was going to kill somebody, but he didn't."
Wow, that's quite a story. Confrontation like that can often help someone build their confidence. Do you have any stories where it shows that your confidence is building through your teenage years? Because you're pretty confident as an adult. Can you share a story with our audience that shows you coming of age, building of confidence? Can you give us something like that?
So this one time, I was getting about 15 years old then, and big, burly, strapping boy, and I wasn't scared of nothing. And so I says to these other three pals of mine, I said, "Let's go up and see the Indians."
So you're going to go up to see the Indians in Indian Territory. I guess that's the way to build confidence. I'm looking forward to hearing this story.
They said, "All right." So I took my .22 along, and we shot 8 rabbits. There was 4 of us, and we had 2 apiece on our saddle. We drove up there and asked this old Indian if he wanted to trade pine nuts for these rabbits. And yes, he'd like to do that. I'd taken a flour sack, one of them 50-pound flour sacks with me, and we got that almost a fourth full of pine nuts for those 8 rabbits. And in the meantime, the woman, she couldn't talk, but she motioned for us to come and eat out of the pine nuts with them, see? And so we got down there, and that's when they're really good. Them Indians know how to roast them, and boy, they was good. We sat there eating them, and I looked over, and there was a little Indian girl there. I imagine she's about 14, 15 years old. But she was more white. She wasn't as dark as they was, and her hair wasn't as black and heavy like theirs. It was more shiny and stringy. And so I looked at her, and she was cute. Oh, she was real cute. And I'd wink at her, and then she'd duck her head. And first thing you know, she'd look up again, and I'd wink at her again.
Oh, my gosh. That's pretty brave to do right in Indian Territory. Did anybody see you doing that?
And I could see this old buck Indian watching me. And I thought, well, he'll be saying something pretty quick. And went on. The old lady walked up once and seen me wink at her, and she laughed. So we kept on eating. And pretty quick, the old boy said, "Hey, you." And boy, I about jumped out of my skin.
I bet.
And I says to the guy, "Stay with me now." I figured he was going to do something. So went over and he said something to his wife. I don't know what it was. I guess it was go get some pine nuts because that's what she'd done. He brought back two of these little wood bowls full of pine nuts and handed me one and him one. He says, "Now you pretty fast pine nut eater, I know." He says, "I'll bet you me beat you." And I said, "Okay." He said, "No, go to let's eat now." And we started eating. And man, I never seen so many pine nuts come out of one guy's mouth in my life. He'd throw them in one side and he'd flip out the other. He never even touched them with his hand, hardly. And he was all done and I was about half done. He says, "You awful fast pine nut eater, but me faster." And I said, "You sure are." I said, "That's faster than I could ever think of eating those pine nuts."
You know, Grandpa, the funny thing about the story is you see an adult male come in and take control of the situation. And he understands if there's anything on a young man's mind, it's probably girls and food. And food is probably the most important. So he takes the food and he basically changes the whole situation and your focus. You're not focused on the girl anymore. You're focused on the food. That's a great story. Thank you so much for sharing. Now, in the first episode, we talked about some of your experiences just out in Alamo, living on the ranch. But now you're a young man and you have lots of experiences working with animals. Tell us about that part of your young man life.
The thing I used to like was ride horses and break horses. I used to break horses for guys up there. And we had five brood mares and we'd raise five colts every year. And when they'd get 2.5, 3 years old, we'd start breaking them. Then the government would come through there and buy them off of us, and they'd give us $100 a piece for these horses. And I says to the guy one day, I says, "How come you give us $100 and you'll only give the others 50? He says, "Because yours is broke good." He says, "When you get a horse from you, it's really broke." He says, "They're good leaders, and they drive good, and they ride good." He'd try them out. And my dad and I used to hitch them up, and we'd drive them around for a while, and then I'd ride them. And we'd learn them to lead good, lead them around behind, they just led real fine. So he'd stay there all night with us, and the next morning, try them out, and then he'd tie them behind his horses. And I said, "How come you tie ours at the back?" And he says, "Well," he says, "they don't pull back," and he says, "they won't pull the tails out of the others." And he says, "This way," he says, "why we can, they get along lots better." And so every year he'd come through there and buy those horses off of us. And we just try to do the best we could to train them so that they'd be good horses for him. And that's the reason why we could sell them for $100 and the others only get 50.
Sounds to me like you're a natural trainer, Grandpa. Do you have any good hunting stories for us by chance?
Just before we moved down, the fall before we moved down, why my dad got me a brand new repeater, Winchester repeating 22. He's in 500 shells, and he said, "Son, I want you to kill some of those rabbits up there." And I'd take a box up every night. I'd go up there, and there was a ditch. They'd stop and drink at that, and then they'd go across and start to eat on the hay and the grain. They'd take about 100 or 150 feet clear around the field. They'd just keep eat off. And I used to sit there and shoot them things. And I was really good shot, too. And Dad says, "Make every shot count." So I'd shoot them right in the shoulder. And I never did shoot too far. I'd wait till they come in close. Oh, they was thick all over. And I'd shoot. Lots of times I'd get 50 out of a box. So that fall, we had a rabbit drive. And I went up the river and found me a nice big club. It just like these, kind of a shinny club. And it was really a good one. And I was just having all kinds of fun. And the rabbits, we made this rabbit drive. And as they was running through, some of them would go between us. I'd hit them with this club. So I was getting pretty tired anyway. And this Melvin Yates come over to me and he says, "Ernie," he said, "I'll trade you this 16-gauge shotgun and 2.5 boxes of shells for that club." And I said, "Boy, that's a trade." And his horse was nervous and he couldn't shoot off him very good. And I just turned my little horse loose and turned around and sat backwards in the saddle. And as they'd run past, then I'd shoot him. And we must have killed 400 or 500 on one drive there that would get by us. And so when we got over to the pen where we was going to drive them in, everybody from all over the country came to this rabbit drive. We must have had 300-400 people out there. And we run them into this little trail we had there, and they were so thick in there that they were just 2 feet deep, rabbits on top of one another. And they put a couple of girls in there was going to kill him. And they had the girls down before you could say Jack Robinson. And then they put a couple of dogs in there, and them dogs would grab them, and they'd run right up over the dogs and build them up in the corner and get out. So they had to put two guys in there with pick handles, and they killed them all, and they piled them up out there. And we got 3,500 that first, 3,600. We got 3,600 that first day. So the next Saturday, we done it again, went right over the same ground, and we got 3,000 more. They piled all those rabbits up in one pile, and they froze. I used to go up there, Dad would send me up there the wagon, and I'd get a wagon load full of them, bring them down, and then we'd feed them to the pigs. We had quite a bunch of pigs in there, spatting them out. And boy, they'd just eat them right up. It seemed to me like to eat fur and all. I didn't see anything laying around after they got done. And that's how we got rid of those rabbits.
Wow. I can't imagine an activity like that happening in today's world. And it sounds like the whole community was involved. What kind of activities did you do with your family when it comes to hunting?
When I got this new 22, my mother used to go out with me. I'd say, I'm going to hunt chickens, Mother. She said, I'll be right with you, son. She'd come and she'd go out with me, and I'd shoot four or five. And time we got to the house, she'd have them all skinned and cleaned and ready to wash. And she'd wash those chickens up, clean them up good, put them in salt and water. The next day, she'd fry them for dinner first. So she was right with me all the time when we'd go hunting chickens. That way, she says, don't have the mess around the house to clean. It's out in the field.
Such a different time period. Tell us about your musical interests as a young man. How did that come to fruition?
We used to get these Montgomery Ward catalogs, and I'd look through this catalog, and I found these band instruments and this trumpet, and it was a beauty. I thought it was the best thing I'd ever seen. It was $34, but I never did think I could ever get that. So I marked it anyway, and it went on, and on my 13th birthday, here come Dad out with his trumpet in a new case, new trumpet, and give it to me for my birthday. Boy, did I think I was something then. I was the only one in the band with the silver trumpet, and boy, it was a new, nice one. I really thought a lot of that. And I played that thing so much that I wore it right out. I've still got it, but it's worn out to where your valves don't work, and it's just really used up good.
I think that's great that music was such a large part of your young life.
Another thing, when we was living up there, my sister and I used to be quite a dance team. We'd step dance. My dad was really good at that, and he could really taught us how to do all these step dances. They used to have these shows up there, three-act plays, and then we'd, while they was changing the scenery and that, they'd have us step dance and things like that in between. And he'd dress us up and he'd play the mouth organ, and we'd go out there and we'd have a new step for every time.
What a great opportunity, having some fun with your family doing that.
We got along real nice that way. We got to go around all the little towns and with this show, and we had lots of fun. We had more fun up there than you could shake a stick at.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for sharing that with us, Grandpa. Now, you're growing up and you're about ready to move to Utah. Is there anything else you wanted to share with us about what happened to you and your experiences in Alamo, Idaho, before you moved to Utah?
I may have missed a few things, but that's all of Alamo that I can think of right off now. So here we go for Utah. We're moving back down to Utah now.
Okay, that's great. Tell us where you're settled.
I remember we got down here to Five Points. We traded for a house right there on the corner of Five Points where Wayne's Guard's parking lot is now. And it used to be the old Brig Robinson home. I remember when we down there, there were three boys from out the Alamo came down with us to help these people move back out, the Larsons move back out to the ranch. They had a little Shetland pony team there. They used to drive around, and they was cute little things, and nice hug harness and buggy, but they wouldn't ride. They wouldn't let nobody ride them, and I remember these three big boys was trying to ride Dave's man, they was, and they tried to ride these ponies, and they'd throw them off so easy. There was nothing to it. So When I come by, I says, why don't you ride them? And he says, well, I'll bet you an ice cream soda you can't ride them. And I says, okay, I'll bet all three of you. So they held him while I got on, and I reached around and got a hold of his tail and brought it right back up over my leg and grabbed a hold of his mane and wrapped my legs around him. And I says, turn him loose. And that thing bucked and twisted and turned, but he couldn't throw me off. The reason he sold those others off, he was so fat and that, and he'd just rear up in the back, and they'd fall off over his head every time. But I had this horse's tail to hold me back. He said, you smart cookie, you. And he said, let's go get them sodas. They took me over there, and they ordered three ice cream sodas, and I had to eat all three of them.
Of course.
I thought I was going to die before I got fall down. I didn't eat ice cream sodas for a month or 6 weeks after that. Then another thing, when we first moved down, I had never seen very many picture shows, one or two, I think, in my whole life. It was real interesting. You'd get on the streetcar and ride to town. Cost you five. They'd give us a quarter. Mother would give us a quarter, and it cost us a nickel to go in. 10 cents for the show, 5 cents down to Ross and Jack's for a hot dog, and 5 cents to come home. That was our evening entertainment. And we'd do that every Saturday night. We'd go in and see this show. It's a cowboy show, and we enjoyed it. We really had a lot of fun about it.
That's kind of fun to hear what you would do as a teenager going to town. I'm really interested on the transportation, because you would jump onto a trolley car and get there, and that's very different than what we know as Weber County today. Now, you were moving to the Ogden area, but you settled in Far West.
It wasn't too long till Dad made a trade out here, the old Far West home that we had here, and so I don't know how he got me out there, but I went out and got the team, and I dug a part of a sack of potatoes Mother wanted and took in. And I was coming back out to bring some furniture and stuff out, and I got there by Harrisville, this little old dummy engine that used to run to Plain City. From Harrisville to Plain City was sitting there, and I was watching that. And first thing you know, I heard a loud whistle, and there was that big old engine train right on top of me almost. The horses had to turn and go up along with the track. We almost got hit. And I thought that was the longest train I'd ever seen. I wanted to see that little engine again, see what happened to it. Pretty quick, the train went by, and I went on and stopped, and I looked at that little engine. And then I went on down with the horses and took them down to the old place. But that little engine used to run, I guess every 2 hours it would run up and down that track.
So even out in Far West, you were able to use the train system to get around?
When we wanted to go to town, we'd get on that and ride up to Harrisville. It cost us a nickel. And then when we got to Harrisville, it cost us a dime to go from there into town on the trolley. And then at 11 o'clock, we'd come back out. Lots of times the little engine would be shut down there. They wouldn't be running it unless there was a big crowd or something extra. Then we'd have to walk from there to Far West home. But we used to go in nearly every Saturday night to that deal. And it was fun to ride that little trolley. I guess you'd go down the road, and we'd swing back and forth, and didn't know whether it was going to jump off the track or not.
That's a fun picture you just painted for me. It's just fun to think of you doing that. Now, music played such a big part of your life while you were in Alamo. Did it play a big part of your life while you were in Ogden? Tell me about that.
Just after we moved out to Far West there, my dad started the orchestra up again, and we'd get different piano players. We had Mabel Erickson played with us for a while. Bessie Taylor, Riley Taylor's wife, played with us for a while. Then a lady from over town, there's two from town, that played with us for a while. And I can remember after we'd been down here for a while, Dad and I both played in the Ogden City Band for a while, and then it was so far in there, and so we didn't go into practice, and so we quit that. But he started playing for dances over at the Five Points. In the old Waynesgard store upstairs, there used to be a dance hall. I guess it's still there, but they used to come up there to dances, and we had this four-piece orchestra, and it got such a crowd, and we thought, well, we had another piece that would help us out. So this Professor Nichols, he was teaching the high school or the industrial school band then, and Red Nichols was his son. So we had him playing with us.
And for those of you who don't know in our audience, Red Nichols was a pretty famous cornet player.
Red used to come up about every Saturday night and sit in and play a tune or two with us, and him and I would play duets together. So Red Nichols' dad says, "Ernie, if you come and play duets with Red, says I'll give you lessons, two lessons a week free." And I was all set to do it, and Red, you know, used to play in the industrial school band too. And then he says, "You can get a suit like, we'll buy you a suit like Red's got, and you can play in the band, the industrial school band." Boy, that stopped it right now. I didn't want nothing to do with it. I was scared to death people would think I was in the industrial school, so I didn't take him up on that. But he kept on, and we kept playing anyway for a while. And finally, when the summer came, why, it was so warm up there that we quit playing, and then we never had Nichols play with us anymore. And I never heard no more about Red, I guess, for another year or so. And one day, he'd come out in the paper that Red Nichols was going to, and his Five Pennies would be playing over to, on a record, over to Glenn Brothers. That's when it was on Keysel Avenue there. So we, three or four of us, rode our bicycles over to hear Red Nichols and his Five Pennies. I stood there and listened to that thing a couple of times, then rode all the way home again.
I wonder if you were thinking to yourself, that could have been me up there. I could have been playing with him. Did you ever see him again?
I didn't see Red anymore for that for a long, long while. One day I was over at the City and County Building, and here come Red walking in and his sister. And I looked at him for a minute and I thought, gee, that's somebody I know. And just as I said, was knew who it was, why, he said, "Ernie, boy, how are you?" And he ran over and shook hands with me, and we sat there and talked for about a half hour, and his sister kept saying, "Come on, Red, let's go up to the rest of the place. I want to introduce you to the rest of them." He wouldn't go for a long while, and finally we sat there and talked, and finally he said, "Well, Ernie, maybe I better go." And I said, "Well, I'll see you Saturday night down to Lagoon."
And Lagoon was a place where musicians would go to perform and people would go to dance. That's great. Grandpa, you told us about running. Were you involved with any other sports in your youth?
I used to be quite a baseball fan. Far West had quite a team here. Will Sharp and Del Brown, Clarence Stevenson. They had a real good team. So I went up to Liberty once with them. When they got up there, there was one man short. So he says, "Ernie, go out in the field and chase the balls and throw them back into us." I said, "I'm not going out there and just chase them. I'm going to catch them." So I went out there and I caught four or five balls, and I got one good hit and made a run. From then on, I played with them the rest of the year.
Grandpa, it sounds like you had a fun and youthful life. Lots of energy, lots of experiences. Thank you for sharing those with us. We hope you join us again on the Family Story Podcast for episode number 3, where we talk about Grandpa turning into a man, taking on a full-time job, and how does that work with a baseball schedule? The best part about it, though, is that he meets Grandma. So we do hope you join us again on the Family Story Podcast. Have a great day. Thank you for joining us today on the Family Story Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Family Story Podcast is a production of Harmony Audio Recordings. This podcast is strictly prohibited for use without permission. For more information about Family Story Podcast or to create your own Family Story Podcast, contact us at familystorypodcast.com. We hope you join us again soon and encourage you to go create a family memory today.